Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Scott Zimmerman. Scott is an optical engineer and a photobiology researcher. He has worked for many years on the engineering side, building and designing light bulbs and other devices. He's also done a lot of photobiology research. He's written a number of papers. I read one recently called Melatonin and the Optics of the Human Body, which was fascinating. And I talked with Scott about the optics of the human body, photobiology, how our bodies respond to light, and light itself, the different types of light that are out there, from sunlight to firelight to LED versus incandescent light bulb light. We talked about how the light spectrum differs from all of these sources and how that impacts our bodies. One of the things that I didn't really appreciate until recently is that it's not just our eyeballs that detect light. Actually, the entire surface and even the cells inside of our body are sensitive to light in different ways. So for example, Scott told me about near infrared light, which we mostly cannot see. It's not visible light, but it can penetrate several inches into the human body, and it has quite striking effects on our physiology. It can influence our mitochondria. It can influence melatonin production. And I've recently learned that melatonin is not just a hormone secreted by the pineal gland to regulate our circadian rhythms and coordinate our sleep-wake cycles across day and night. It's actually one of the most potent antioxidants in the body, and it's produced all over the body. So we talked about how mitochondria respond to light and near infrared light in particular. We talked about some of the effects that artificial light has compared to sunlight. We discussed his views on red and near infrared light therapy and whether or not he thinks that's beneficial or what some of the risks are. We talked about skin color and how that influences how much light you can absorb, how deeply different wavelengths go into the body. We talked about his approach to his relationship with sunlight. He actually conducted this interview outside from his house in the evening sun. He talked about his use of sunscreen. He talked about what sunscreen filters out, which is UV light, but also what it does not filter out, which is pretty much all other wavelengths of light, and how those wavelengths, even though they're not causing mutation and sunburn like UV light does, they still cause oxidative stress. And so Scott actually said that he doesn't use sunlight, and he takes other measures to protect himself from sunburns. So if you're interested in skin and light detection, if you're interested in photobiology, how our body responds to light, if you're interested in the detrimental health effects of artificial lighting and what we're missing out on with artificial lighting by and large, what is coming from the sun and all of that stuff. If you're interested in any of that stuff, this will be a really interesting episode. I learned a whole lot about sunlight and different light sources and how our bodies actually respond to it that I had no idea about before. So I think this is actually pretty cool stuff that has some practical applications that you can use. As always, don't forget to check out the Mind and Matter Substack, mindandmatter.substack.com, for all of my podcast content, my long-form science writing, and my free weekly newsletter. Look for the link in the episode description. This episode is supported in part by Athletic Greens. Their main product, AG1, is a comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition product containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients with less than 1 gram of sugar per serving, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything. It's gluten and dairy free and compatible with paleo, vegan, vegetarian, and ketogenic diets. AG1 is a quick and convenient way to supplement your diet to help ensure your body is getting the nutrients it needs. It comes in powder form, and you can mix it in water and drink it, or you can put it into a smoothie or a shake or something like that. I mix it into water and drink it, and it's super convenient. If you go to athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Their vitamin D product comes in tincture form, so you just take one drop each day. A large fraction of the population is actually vitamin D deficient, especially in winter months when we get less sun exposure. And vitamin D is super important for the proper function of the immune system and for a variety of other things. So visit athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter or click the link in the episode description. You'll get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. And with that, here's my conversation with Scott Zimmerman.
Your background, I looked a little bit, but I didn't get a full update on.
Yeah, so my background is in research science. So I did a PhD in neuroscience, and I was a researcher for a number of years. and then moved into the technology sector in the cannabis industry, actually. And I worked in that for a number of years. And now I pretty much just do this and some consulting advisory work on the side. Cool. But I've been, you know, I've been interested in learning more about the effects of light beyond the obvious. Obviously, we have a visual system that allows us to see things. That's actually partly what I did my PhD research in. We all know about UV light and its mutagenic effects. And, you know, that's the reason why we are so often wearing sunscreen. But it's only been fairly recently for me that I've come to learn more and appreciate that, you know, the other wavelengths of light are also having really interesting physiological effects. And you seem to be a good person to talk to about that.
Well, you know, I think it's an amazing field, to be quite honest. It hasn't really been tapped into very well. I mean, there's been a lot of work done on photobiomodulation and red light therapies and things of that nature that got some kind of mixed reviews from the medical community and all that. But what I was amazed is that there really wasn't, I'm an optics guy, you know, so I was just amazed that there was so little known about the differences and the similarities there are, you know, in the body and how it functions optically, especially in the near infrared, because you have to move from a two-dimensional to more of a three-dimensional way of looking at it, because there's so much penetration and propagation that occurs at some wavelengths. Mm. And I think, have you seen Bob Fosbury's pictures in the near infrared of the hand and things?
No, I don't think so.
Well, when we get done, I'll ship you some pictures. But what you start to find out is that on an optic standpoint, we're pretty infinitesimal in our infant in our maturity of our ability to even measure or to measure or to essentially model how light propagates in the body. Unfortunately, most people go and they grab a cadaver or a sheep's head and they put a laser on the outside and they measure, put a detector on the inside and say, oh, you only get 5% transmission. Well, that's a bogus way of making the measurement. It doesn't actually work that way when you're dealing with scattering volumes. It's one of the hardest measurements to make in optics there is. Mm. And so what happens is that I like to give people kind of an analogy. You know, if you put an ice cube, nice clear ice cube, in front of that laser and you have a detector sitting back there, then you get almost all the light, almost 100% transmission, less the Fresnel losses. If you take that same size and you make it a snowball, that's a nice cube, same size, you shine the laser into it, the entire thing lights up and the transmission goes down to next to nothing. Because what happens is most of the light is scattering into the volume and changing its direction and reflecting back, doing twice snows white and all this other great stuff. So, you know, unfortunately, to try and model that is extremely complex and hard to do. And really, we lack a lot of the body is a lot farther along in you doing optics in the body than we are in our ability to actually model it and understand it.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, right? I mean, we've been interacting as, you know, creatures walking the earth. We have a very, very long evolutionary history with the sun present as a huge environmental stimulus. And so our bodies have adapted to it and you know, figured out, so to speak, how to respond to and utilize that light in ways that are beyond our, you know, beyond our ability to model it, as you said.
Yeah, well, and unfortunately, there's been some pretty sloppy, myself included, but there's been some sloppy use of terminology. It's like if you look and people talk about daylight, well, they talk about daylight only in terms of, or care about it in terms of usually of what we can see with our eye. Mm. And yet that represents only 10% of the solar spectrum. And that was the part that was just so amazing to me is the minute I started looking at, okay, how does light propagate in the body? You start to see that the body is actually doing things optically to increase the ratios of near infrared to visible, especially in the brain. You know, if you do actually look at how the light propagates in the brain, it gets through the skin, through the skull in the near infrared, and then it gets literally light guided down into the fissures of the brain. And it just happens that all the gray matter is out on the outside periphery. Optically, it makes total sense. Now,
yeah, let's back up for a second and give people some concepts and some background here. But let's just talk about sunlight first of all. So you just mentioned, right, that as many people sort of underappreciate, the visible part of the sunlight spectrum is only a fraction of what's actually coming from the sun. Can you talk a little bit about just sunlight in general? What does that full light spectrum look like? How much of it is near infrared light? What is near infrared light? And what do we, if we go outside during the day, what are we actually being exposed to?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You know, sunlight runs from 250 nanometers down to beyond 3000 nanometers. And of that, about 10% of it is the visible, and running from 400 to 700, depending on how you want to, you know, these are kind of artificial things that we define visible to be X and near infrared to be Y. Mm-hmm. But to some extent, but what you have is that, like, you walk outside, you're looking at a blue sky, and everybody says blue bad, blue bad. You know, no, blue's not bad, but the blue that you see in a blue sky is actually a very broadband distribution of wavelengths that has a gives you the impression of blue. It's a blue, cyans, all these different colors. But then if you go on out, and bear in mind that most of the problem is that most of the laboratories don't have the capability to measure accurately or easily the near infrared. So it's been kind of ignored. And so what you see in that blue sky is that there's this huge tail, long tail of near infrared that is built into what you see as blue. But not only that, you have to think about it from the standpoint of for what we're doing, I really could care less what goes through the pupil. It's not what I'm looking at. I'm looking at what is the body absorbing and taking into itself. And in the near infrared, what happens is that when you walk outside, it's not just the sun from the light from the sun. It's the light from the Raleigh scatter that gives you the blue haze and all or the blue color of the sky. But then if you look at what happens in your surroundings, the plants around you are strongly absorbing visible wavelengths. That's how we can tell whether or not that's a good apple or a bad snake, a good snake. So that's very important. But in the near infrared, all those plants are reflecting near infrared. So you're kind of walking around in this integrating sphere of light that's predominantly near infrared. And in our work, it matters how many square meters of skin or of body are you is getting absorbing energy.
So when we go outside in the sunlight, it's not just photons that have done a straight shot from the sun down to Earth and onto our bodies. It's also photons that get scattered in the atmosphere and then get to us that reflect off of plants and other things and bounce back up to us. And it's this whole sort of ecosystem of light.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, the point is that, you know, those you think about from a solid, you know, solid angle, you know, three dimensionally here. You know, light's coming down from the sun, like I'm outside now. I'm getting my head and my forehead and all that. But in general, it's got a fairly low solid angle that is coming into my body. But surrounding me, everything around me is reflecting that light and coupling it in into a much larger area, solid angle. So you're getting all this near infrared in particular. Kicking even dirt has a higher reflectivity in the near infrared than it does in the visible.
Are we hitting our body? It sounds like there's more near infrared light than you would expect from just considering the direct sunlight. Because
absolutely.
Okay, I see.
Absolutely. And what we've been trying to get people to understand or to look at is that when you're in direct sunlight, high noon, if you look at on an optical watts basis, there's one optical watt of visible. Well, then there's one optical watt of near infrared in that direct sunlight. But then the minute you start to look at how strongly the other stuff absorbs the visible, all of a sudden, once you walk under a shade tree, that ratio of near infrared to visible in optical watts increases to 3 to 1. You go and you walk down and you sit around a campfire. It's 10 to 1.
Oh.
And then when optically what happens is, which is absolutely the most humbling and amazing thing, I think, is that the body then goes and it does certain things in our most sensitive tissues to guarantee that that ratio is even higher. Like in your eye, most of the photons that actually hit the retina don't go through your pupil. They actually go through your sclera and your eyelids and scatter into the in the near infrared, because the transmission, your eyelids, if you could walk outside and you're in a sunny day and you close your eyes and you look up towards the sun, you'll see this orange glow. Well, that is the red edge that then opens up this transmission window in the near infrared. So, and what's amazing is the eye has a larger transmission window as far as the humor and all that other stuff in the near infrared than it does in the visible. Why? Well, because the near infrared is stimulating blood flow, oxygenation, to reduce glucose. It's having these other effects, and the body has made a choice over adaptation of millions of years that it has a imaging optic, which is through your pupil, but it has a non-imaging collector, which is gathering light near infrared in particular and making sure that it goes on the retina. The retina is the most blood or the most metabolically active tissue we have. The same thing happens with the brain from the standpoint of you can easily, have you ever, told a ghost story and shoved a pen light up your nose or whatever, and you turn nice red? Well, that's again, the red edge. If you go into the near infrared, literally the light is pumped into the cerebral spinal fluid, which then is because of it has a peak transmission in the near infrared and low scatter. So it then light guides it down into the fissures of the brain. The most amazing thing is that when you're looking at a woman who's a pregnant woman, what happens when the early part of the pregnancy is her skin and all that filters out the greens and the blues and the UV, but allows some level of transmission of the near infrared. As the pregnancy progresses, the skin starts to stretch. It expands the spectrum that the fetus is exposed to. The amniotic fluid has a peak transmission in the near infrared as well. And so you start seeing all these different things that the body is doing to essentially increase, especially at critical times like the fetal development, the amount of near infrared that is being provided relative to the visible. Doesn't mean the blue's bad or anything, but
yeah. So it sounds like, obviously light is a huge stimulus for us. It historically was an even bigger stimulus when we weren't, living in houses all day long. So, with such a huge stimulus, naturally organisms are going to be evolving at adaptations that enable them to survive in the presence of that stimulus, take advantage of that stimulus to do, to do things that are going to facilitate survival. What you're saying is that the infrared is such a large component that in many ways, just the biomechanical structural adaptations of the body have evolved over time to actually sort of almost magnify the effects of the near infrared.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always an advantage. If you look at when I first, I guess I'm trying to make it clear is that, the body has gone to extreme lengths to guarantee that it is, like I say, increasing the ratio of near infrared to visible. Then what we're seeing from all the photobiomodulation and red light, that red light, longer wavelengths have a huge impact on a wide range of different biological functions. And, I've been working a lot with Glenn Jeffrey over in England, and he's done this really great study where he took and exposed just four square, a small area on a person's back with red light and a short duration, and all of a sudden, and under a glucose challenge, and he was able to show that the red light causes the glucose levels to drop systemically, even though he's only exposing a small patch of the body, but he's showing that it's changing biologically the homeostasis, or whatever you want to call it, the baseline against which we are operating when we're exposed to these longer wavelengths.
So if a small patch of skin is exposed to red light, it can affect body-wide blood glucose levels?
That's what it appears to be going on within the thing. And you think about it, you know, Glenn makes the point. He says, you know, you can't have one part of your body doing one thing and the other part of the body doing the other thing, something else entirely, and there not be a consequence. So there's this natural effect where they, you know, you start to have a hot spot someplace. Well, you tend to the rest of the body kicks in to kind of make everything okay. You know, and what, so I think that's, to me, is really fascinating that's going on. But
so for the people that don't know, can you just give us a basic physical definition for red and near infrared light, and then start to talk about some of the, you know, what are some of the more salient physiological effects that we know those bands of light can cause in a human?
Okay, well, I mean, again, we kind of arbitrarily picked what we define. If you look at the CIE, they go from 380 out to 850. But in reality, in our world now, you know, we're talking about 400 nanometers to about 650 nanometers is our definition of visible light when we provide it artificially. Mm-hmm. But what, to me, what defines where you should divide the two, and deep red and near infrared are kind of, to me, kind of lumped together, is where you have that red edge, you know, where all of a sudden we go from something that is fairly strongly absorbing to something that is allowing propagating deep into the body. And that occurs somewhere around the 630 to 650 nanometer region and runs up to 700. But, you know, that those biological, what you end up with is a series of biological windows in the near infrared where light can propagate inches into the body. And that's where you have to move from, as I said, you know, if you're looking at UV, most of it happens, almost all the photons are absorbed in the outer 50 microns to millimeter max, you know, blues and cyans. But in the near infrared, it's quite the opposite. You know, you get into the longer wavelengths, and within these biological windows where absorption is very low and the scatter is very forward, what we call anisotropic forward scatter, you get this effect, like I said, like the ice cube, where you're essentially distributing the you know, if I have, you know, I cover up everything but one little spot on my head or whatever, and I allow the near infrared, it's going to propagate out into a much larger area. And you're also having this biological effect where it's signaling to the other mitochondria that you guys need to kick into gear here, because I'm getting, you know, I'm getting burned, or I'm getting, you know, so whatever. And so it to me, it's an amazingly complex arrangement, but it kind of makes sense when you start thinking about how the body has had to adapt to this environment. I mean, you know, it's just a huge amount of energy. I mean, people, if you look at it historically, the energy from the sunlight into the body has been the largest energy input to the body, you know, period. It's more than food. It's more than anything else. It's like 30 megajoules, up to 30 megajoules a day. And that's a huge amount of energy. But if you look at it then from the standpoint of how much of that is near infrared, it's actually can be as high as 90% of that can be near infrared.
And it's penetrating
filtering.
And you said the near infrared can penetrate several inches into the body. I mean, that makes sense when I think about it from a physics standpoint, but, you know, normally we just think of light hitting the surface of the skin and, you know, bouncing right off or not going very deep. If it's going 4 inches deep, it's touching the cells of my internal organs and that's
exactly stuff. Exactly. And what we're trying to show is that, especially with children, your penetration depth, the characteristics are the same whether you're a child or adult or a female or whatever. But if you look at it from a standpoint of smaller children in particular, almost 100% of their cells are seeing some level of near infrared. It's been filtered out the blue and the greens, but they're exposed to it. And we're showing, you know, Glenn's showing, and we tried to show with our melatonin research and stuff is that it's having a huge impact on their hormone levels. Well, now all of a sudden, what do we do? We went in, we said, okay, kids shouldn't play outside. They're going to get skin cancer. We sit inside, watch on our computer all day in a building that has a near infrared blocking glass glazing that's preventing it from. So I would say, I keep on trying to say is that we are looking at the largest reduction in solar exposure in human history. Nobody notices it per se, but that's what's actually happened. And it's, and because, you know, people don't see near infrared, so how do they know it's not there, you know? But again, if you look at it from the physiological effects we know of, we know that it affects glucose levels. We know that it impacts hypertension. We know that it impacts anxiety and a number of neurological things. We know that it impacts what hormone generations and hormone ratios. And my big concern is that what we've created with our artificial environment is that we are like under constant stimulation to generate cortisol. And
why is that? Does this have to do with the more blue light and the lower ratio of infrared to visible light?
Well, what it has to do with it, that we're constantly, cortisol is important. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's not important, but it's a fight or flight response. It's designed to actually protect us. So when you get all of a sudden a bunch of bright light into your face, your cortisol level go. You go eat a bunch of stuff, your cortisol levels go up. You get any activity, exercise activity, your cortisol. But in nature, when we're in nature, there is a complementary effect associated with, you know, we got 9 orders of magnitude of from direct sunlight all the way down to moonlight. And so that kind of control system can only be done using ratios of opposing things. So cortisol is opposed by melatonin. What we showed in our biology paper was that, hey, during exercise or doing anything or going outside, all of a sudden the cortisol levels go up. Doesn't matter what time of day it is. You know, this is totally independent of circadian. The tide goes up, but so does melatonin. You know, where is melatonin being created at 9 a.m. at levels that are 3 or 4 times what it is at nighttime? Well, it's because all these our cells are literally generating melatonin. And this has been a debate that's been going on for 40 years about what's all this melatonin come from? Well, I think what we've shown that it's from, you know, when you start doing exercise, your muscle cells generate reactive oxygen species. And in response, it starts generating tons of melatonin because it's an amazing antioxidant.
I see. Yeah, I knew that melatonin was a strong antioxidant. But what I didn't know until recently, and what I think most people don't appreciate, is when we think about melatonin, we usually think about melatonin that gets produced when light levels go down. It's called the hormone of darkness. And we think about it coming from the brain, from the pineal gland, and entering into circulation and being important for setting and coordinating the circadian rhythm of the body that dictates our sleep-wake cycles and other things. But what you're saying is melatonin doesn't just come from the pineal gland. It's not just for the circadian biology. It's actually produced in, it sounds like, all cells or most cells?
All cells, because I mean, you think about it, what the experiment was really quite simple. They took a number of people, they put them on treadmills and are on stair steppers, and they monitored their melatonin levels at 9 a.m. in the morning, and they did the exercise for 4 hours. You know, it was a pretty strenuous exercise. What you saw was within 10 minutes, the melatonin level in the blood went up to 200 picograms per milliliter. That's 2 or 3 times what it normally would be at night when it's supposed to be doing what it's doing. And I'm not discrediting or arguing with circadian at all. It's a process, but in order for the brain to function at 80%, it's got to generate a ton of reactive oxygen species. Mm-hmm. The most potent antioxidant we have is melatonin, because it cascades down. All its metabolites are also antioxidants, so you get this cascading effect. So the brain, the body, you know, in its infinite wisdom, made a pineal gland, generates melatonin during periods of low cellular activity, when it there isn't much being generated by the other cells, and when the brain actually needs some kind of help. And like I say, I mean, it's more than just an accident that melatonin was selected for the pineal gland. But now what we're showing is that if you do, and the only way you can really measure circadian melatonin is you put somebody out on a bed, make them quiet in the dark, and then you can start seeing these circadian effects. The minute you turn on a light or shake them or make them go do a little bit of exercise, all bets are off. Those hormone levels are moving rapidly. And so what was just absolutely fascinating was is that this, in particular, Theron's work showed that melatonin, you know, ramped up within 10, 20 minutes to very high levels and then plateaued during the exercise. And then once you quit the exercise, it went back down. So you have a great dose response, you know, argument going on.
Where is this melatonin being synthesized? Where is it coming from within cells?
The highest level of in the mitochondria itself, it appears. That's the argument.
I see. Okay, so it hasn't been shown directly, but I guess the argument would be the mitochondria, you know, these are the organelles within our cells that produce ATP, the energy currency that we use to power our cells. This is the site of oxidative phosphorylation and the whole chain of events that makes the energy of the cell. That process is naturally pretty intensive, and so it produces a lot of reactive oxygen species. So I guess you would expect the mitochondria to also be equipped with antioxidant capabilities to handle that.
And that was what was kind of cool about this recent paper by Jeffrey is that what he did is he took red light, exposed the area, and not only did he measure that, it was a glucose challenge test. And what he showed is that the people that didn't have the red light, you know, had X level, and the people that did have the red light were 27% lower. But what was even more important was that he measured the CO2 levels. So the CO2 levels then went up when you got the red light exposure, which is a clear indication that the mitochondria is essentially kicking into high gear. And so, you know, because of the way, you know, to generate the ATP and all that other stuff. So, I mean, I think that there's some fairly direct evidence that it is the mitochondria itself. But again, this has been a debate that Russ Ritter has been fighting for 40 years. And, you know, but I do believe that the data from the exercise and from the zoo's work on exercise and being outdoors make it pretty clear that literally all cells are capable of generating the melatonin and a variety of other things. So.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about it in evolutionary terms, so for those listening, you know, recall that mitochondria are organelles of our cells. They produce ATP, the energy that our cells use. They actually evolved from cyanobacteria. So they used to be bacteria effectively, and cyanobacteria are well known for their light sensing and light responding capabilities. Chloroplasts in plants are basically the analog of mitochondria for us, and that's the organelle in plants that is actually photosynthetic. They also came from cyanobacteria. Obviously, they're sensing light. So it makes sense that mitochondria would have these light sensing capabilities based on where they came from. What do we know there about like the different wavelengths that they sense? Is it just near infrared? Is it other wavelengths? Like, what are the light sensing capabilities of the mitochondria?
Well, I mean, if you look at Peter Light's work up in Canada, he actually did some really good work where he did some single cell patch studies where he actually measured the wall potential on individual cells exposed to different wavelengths. And what you find is that within the cell, especially the fat cells, there is actually a higher level of melanopsin in those cells than there is in the retina. You know, so you can probably think evolutionarily, there was a point where we didn't have eyes, but the skin was photosensitive. And then the eyes came into the whole picture, and some of that, you know, some of that melanopsin went into the eye for the circadian characteristics. But then if you look at it from the standpoint of the effect of longer wavelengths, you have to take into account that, you know, I don't have to do much. I don't have to generate much melatonin if I am stimulating all the mitochondria. because you're talking about trillions and trillions of cells of mitochondria that could be stimulated or by the longer wavelengths because it's penetrating so deep in the mind. I would tell everybody to go look at Bob Fosbury's pictures of the hand. What you'll literally see is that the entire hand glows at 850 nanometers, and then you can kind of see the blood vessels. And what it's really showing is it's a cute optical collector system in that, you know, what happens is the light is propagated. Bob calls it scattering in a weakly scattering matrix with weak absorbers. So what happens is that once the light enters the hand, you know, it starts to bounce around and eventually gets to the point that it, you know, that it finds a weak absorber to be absorbed. Yeah, there's a picture of it right there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So for those just listening, yeah, we're looking at this picture. Describe what we're looking at, Scott.
Well, this is 850 nanometer, Bob. Fosbury's done a number of these. I tell everybody, go look at his Flickr page. He's an amazing guy. Anyway, he's got 850 nanometer of LED emitter. He's then got a camera that's sensitive to 850 nanometers. And when you see how the light, this is like he's got his hand over essentially a point source. But then what happens is that it goes into, as I said, like this cube of snow, and it just bounces around. You know, anybody who's built a snow igloo or a snow fort during a sunny day can get the impression of how light scatters and is distributed by these at this level. And the whole key is that in the near infrared, the absorption coefficients are dropping down so low, and the scatter is mostly forward that it lets you kind of fill the volume. And so now you get the impression that in the near infrared, the body is designed to guarantee the high level number of the cells are being exposed in the near infrared. Like I'm sitting out here right now, and I have a t-shirt, I have a shirt on, a pants, shorts, and all that. It doesn't really matter in the near infrared, as Bob also shows. You know, you can have multiple layers of clothing on, and the near infrared actually penetrates through that clothing. So. You know, unfortunately, what's happened in our environment today is that blue's bad. Well, I believe blue's bad because we took the near infrared away.
I see. It's about the ratios.
It is the ratios. Because as I said, any control system has to have a positive and negative feedback component to maintain, you know, equal or stay, you know, steady state. And what we did is we lopped off huge portions of the solar spectrum, and now you've got the stimulation going on for cortisol. You know,
in some sense the light bulbs in many people's homes, we think of it as blue light, but in some sense it might be better to think of it as the lack of other wavelengths of light.
Exactly, that's a great way to put it. And you know, it's hard because, you know, something you can't see is not important to you, you know, compared to the other.
Yeah.
And what I find fascinating is we developed some light sources to try and mimic, add the near infrared back in. And it's children and women in particular that respond to it. Number one, women have much higher color sensitivity than men do. They can tell 15 shades of blue, and we see two. And so never argue with your significant other about that kind of situation, because the reality is she has an advantage over you. Now, we have an advantage over noticing that there's movement in the brush. Mm-hmm. But that's what I've been we've been focused on here lately. I did a podcast with Sarah Pugh on women, and women have entirely different responses to sunlight than men do. And it's
what are some examples? What are some examples of that?
Well, number one, part of it is that women have thinner skin, literally thinner skin. They have less collagen, so more of the light penetrates deeper into their body. They tend to be, we have very little, if any, understanding of its effects on female hormones, but we're trying. It's kind of, I was talking to Sarah, and she said, Scott, did you know that all the majority of the rats that are used for testing drugs are all male? I said, no, I didn't. But it turns out that that's the case. So there's this general lack of understanding. You know, I'd say there's actually, you know, needs to be some key research done in that area to understand what affected the differences. All I can tell you is that
there must be differences light, because the light penetrates to such a different extent.
A different extent. And then there's new indications, some papers that are coming out showing that female mitochondria may be less, they may have less mitochondria, but that mitochondria tends to be more efficient at generating ATP. So, I mean, you know, I guess I'm just trying to make the point that, and then we did, I think to our knowledge, we're about the only people that have actually measured much in the Black community. And what you find is that someone with high melanin content needs 3 to 4 times to even 6 times the amount of near infrared to generate the same level of stimulation that a person who has very low melanin content is. And so, and again, that's another amazing thing where we're so, most of the optical models are based on the assumptions of particular layers with an absorption coefficient, a scatter coefficient, and things of that nature. Yet what the body does is it takes melanin and puts it in a little granule, like a speck of pepper. And what that does is that optically changes how much, so more near infrared actually goes through that situation than if I uniformly distributed the melanin through that layer. So it's, there's all these little tricks the body is doing to optimize the amount of near infrared that is getting into the cells underneath.
When we wear sunscreen, does it block all wavelengths, including near infrared?
No. our paper, what we do is we do optical models and try and understand where the photons are going in the body. And then early on, I was lucky enough to see work by Zostro, where he did a measurement. He was in the cosmetic industry. And what he did is he he measured the amount of free radical generation as a function of wavelength throughout the visible and into a little bit into the near infrared. And what you find is that modern sunscreen is mainly targeting UVA, UVB, and UVC. And then there's a cutoff. But what he showed was that if you take skin and you measure the free radicals in exposure to the UV portion, you get X. If you actually then take the same piece of similar skin and you measure from blocking the UV but putting in the visible, you get X again. There's equal amounts of free radicals being generated in the visible. So what ends up happening when you do sunscreen? Nobody is going to buy sunscreen that makes them look like blackface. Just not going to happen. So what happens is that they cut off in the UVA and make it so that you don't see the effect. But literally, by doing that, the UV portion is what actually gives you sunburn and tells you, hey, dummy, it's time to get in out of the sun. Well, now you block that, you can stay outside longer, but it increases your exposure to the visible portion.
And that is also generating oxidative stress.
Oxidative stress. And if you look at it optically.
So is what you're saying that most sunscreens actually make it easier for people to expose themselves to more oxidative stress because they can stay out in the sun longer?
Yes. And what appears to be the case, if you look at it optically, and we wrote this, showed this in our paper, is that optically, a higher percentage of the blues and violets and cyans are localized in the basal layer, which may explain why men in particular some people have higher levels of basal cell carcinoma, and because that's the cells that are actually getting extra pumping by this using sunscreens. So there was a company down in Australia that tried to introduce some level of blockage or absorption and kind of give you a brown haze, you know, type thing. But to really do it right, I mean, a person with high melanin content is basically immune from melanoma and those type of things. person with white skin is very susceptible to it. But it's also showing that just putting some sunscreen. And my big problem is that we, again, because we're not willing to understand the differences as well as how we're similar, you know, you put generically, almost all makeup now has SPF in it. Mm. Well, someone with a woman with very dark skin, it doesn't actually is struggling to generate enough UVD or vitamin D and other hormones, including estradiol, because the basic components are actually generated in the outer 50 microns of the skin. Hmm. So you're sitting there and you're saying to yourself, you know, we're actually making it worse for all these different groups because we don't want to admit that there's a difference. And it's unfortunate, I think.
Hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, depending on your skin color and your background, depending on if you're male or female, you're going to have different light needs, basically.
Yeah.
But we're giving everyone the same application of things like sunscreens or women's makeup, and it is differentially negatively impacting different types of people with different types of skin.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to advocate you don't put sunscreen on if that's what you want to do, but understand that you're only solving half the problem. Mm. You need to wear a hat. You need to go out and, you know, get a certain amount. And like now, I mean, it's getting later in the day here.
Where are you calling in from?
New Jersey.
And so, okay, so what's the time of day right now? And like, how much is, what do you for yourself consider an appropriate amount of sun, getting out into the sunlight without sunscreen?
What I would suggest is, number one, the best thing is go play under the, go do your stuff under the shade of a tree. If that's not available, then have a hat on. And then B, I would go from, you know, early morning to about 10 or something, and then kind of go into the shade like we are, you would think of, you know, you think an animal doesn't sit out in the middle of the sun, the desert, it goes behind the shade tree, you know?
Yeah. Which,
I mean, you know, some of this is just common sense.
But if you think about it, like modern culture, a lot of people, like, right, they're specifically going out at the beach in the middle of the day, indirect sunlight with no shade on purpose, and not going out in the early morning and near sunset.
Yeah. And, you know, some of that, I mean, most of us go 50, 60, I'm 65. So I haven't gotten any melanoma yet. And I've been, grew up in Kansas putting up hay, and, you know, we didn't have sunscreen back then, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, a little bit of common sense comes into play on this whole thing, in my opinion. You know, you don't want to overdo it, and you start to get a little bit red, go in. But that was the really kind of the, I tried to publish the paper on it, and it got shut down because it basically said, you know, that it's maybe not the best idea to put sunscreen in all these different people. And in particular, if you're only going to block the UV portion, you know, you literally, it's very hard with some of these SPFs that look transparent to generate, you know, even get a sunburn. You know, that's one of their functions. Yeah, I'm not arguing about that. But, you know, the body was designed to essentially tell you, you need to get in out of the sun. And the sunburn is part of that, the parcel of that learning process, I guess I'd say, is, you know, when you're growing up.
Mm-hmm. Could you make the argument that the optimal way to regulate your exposure to the sunlight would be to regulate your own behavior in response to how your skin's responding in the absence of sunscreen, such that you're getting sunlight but avoiding sunburn?
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, I think that you know, people are always looking for a pill or something that lets them do something they know they shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of what I think any of us would be honest, you know, other than the people that really want to get their golden tan, you know, the bottom line is most of us know I really shouldn't just be standing out here without some level of protection. And it doesn't take much. I mean, and like I say, if you look at melanin, its absorption, optical absorption characteristics, strongly absorbs in the UV, and then it drops like a rock down to 700 to 800 nanometers, and it has almost no absorption. And in fact, if I try and mimic melanin using charcoal particles or whatever, what you'll find is that for a broadband absorber, it literally is this long tail versus melanin, which is a spike up in the UV and drops down like a rock in the near infrared, intentionally allowing a large amount of near infrared to be processed through into our cells deeper in the body. Optically, it's amazing.
You mentioned firelight earlier. Can you talk a little bit more about how does the light spectrum of firelight compare to sunlight or, you know, the light bulbs that people are going to typically have in their home?
Well, like an incandescent bulb of old, fire tends to have 10 to 15 to 1 near infrared to visible, contains, you know, some trace levels of blue, but it's almost predominantly in the near infrared. And that was always the problem with incandescent is that 90% of the spectrum that is being emitted by incandescent bulbs is in the near infrared, peaking up around 1 micron. And I would argue that, you know, people say, well, I did fine under fluorescent, all that kind of stuff. But you came home to an incandescent lit room. You went to bed reading a story under an incandescent light. Now you don't. You have this thing that we're talking on that contains zero near infrared. We have a big screen TV that's putting out tons of light at night that has no near infrared component to it. You have, you know, all the windows are low E glass, which block the near infrared from coming into your building or into your home.
When we talk about like LEDs, blue light versus incandescent light bulbs, the incandescent light bulbs emit more near infrared light. And is this, you know, a lot of people have an intuition for like, you know, they look different. A lot of people say I look bad under fluorescent lighting, or they say I feel bad under fluorescent lighting. Is there more to it than just the light perception?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that at that point, that's just a proven point. I mean, how much it degrades. There are certain people, they had a study over in Saudi Arabia where they took various levels of depression and they put them into a room with a fluorescent light versus a incandescent light. And depending on the level of depression that they had, their response was just skyrocketed, you know. And that's what I think that people that were missing is that you or I may be fine, but there's at least a percentage of the population that is being affected. And even you and I are being affected in ways we don't really understand. Your statement about, you know, it feels different. Is that anxiety? Well, we know that there's all these anxiety, you know, that we can alter hormone levels. You know, there was a study done where they looked at schizophrenic and clinically depressed individuals, and they measured the melatonin to cortisol ratios at midnight. Now, according to circadian lore, the melatonin should have been high and the circadian or cortisol should have been low. What they found is there was a 4x difference between people who had schizophrenia measured at midnight that showed that they had a much lower melatonin to cortisol ratio. And I would argue that based on our work, that's the same as saying a near infrared to visible ratio is a similar type effect. And so, you know, built into all this stuff appears to be that the near infrared and longer wavelengths, deep red, is basically modulating how we feel neurologically as well as physically.
Can you talk a little bit more about what's known about the relationship between light exposure and hormone production?
Well, like I say, I mean, if you look at the work, well, number one, you have the light exposure effects on the one side, circadian, but then on the other side, the near infrared, you have that the near infrared is generating elevated levels of melatonin in the outer skin, you know. And I kind of like to say it's kind of like,
and I guess people should know. So melatonin is itself, I think, technically a hormone. It acts at a distance.
It's a hormone. It's a hormone. It's also, you know, we also know that the longer wavelengths are affecting vitamin D production.
Which is going to be a precursor to all the sex steroid hormones.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the skin, the outer part of the skin can generate virtually every hormone in a body in the outer part of the skin, especially the sex hormones, the steroid-based things, cortisol, vitamin D. They not only can they're doing the precursor that goes to our glands, to adrenal glands and things like that. But it's been shown that it can do it de novo. It doesn't need to do it. It has the ability to do it right on site. And you think about it just from a evolutionary, all the actions occurring on the skin, you know, it's having to deal with a whole lot of stuff. And its ability to respond to that, you know, by the time you get around to, I've got something chewing on my arm that's causing me to bleed or whatever, by the time it goes all the way back through the brain, through the gland responds in some hormonal mass effect systemically, it'll be too late and it'll be the inappropriate amount. So instead, there appears to be this localization that occurs of generating various responses, you know, to at the skin level. And it kind of like, it's kind of like most of our medicine is our most of our medical stuff is from the inside out. This is from the outside in type thing. So
in your home, in your own home, what kind of light bulbs and stuff do you have?
I have incandescent and I have our bulb. That's what I do. And our bulb is half incandescent. So that's what we make. Because what we did is when I was doing this, I kept on looking. I looked to talk to, interviewed Hamlin and some of the other photobiomodulation people. And what I found was is they were using exposure levels that were similar to what you'd get in a well-lit incandescent room and had been for 150 years. And then I got to looking at it closer, and then I saw, well, it's actually a little bit of overkill because it's 10 to 1 near infrared to visible. So what we do is we developed a bulb in different subversions, A19s and all that, both DC and AC. And we put in LEDs to generate the visible portion, and we use little filament bulbs to generate the near infrared component. Put the two of them together and you get something that's a closer match to sunlight. And, you know, that's what we do. And we, based on our work, especially with the Black community, we decided on a 3-to-1 ratio. So we save some energy. You can still do 50 lumens to 60 lumens per watt, but you are providing 3 times the amount of near infrared to visible out of that bulb. So, you know, that's what we do.
So, you know, based on what you've told me, basically the modern environment is, in terms of light, is characterized by a lower ratio of red and near infrared to visible and other types of light than it would have been ancestrally for most of human history.
Well, I'd put it even more just succinctly. What we did is we eliminated all near infrared for a lot of people, not just some, all. Because it's not coming in your windows, it's not being emitted by your TV, it's not being emitted by your lighting, and you don't go outside enough, you know?
And because this is such a big piece of natural light exposure from the sunlight, you know, it would be more or less unthinkable that our bodies aren't adapted to getting to that in some way. And so even if we don't know all of the facts at play here, if we think about an evolutionary context, it sort of would have to be true that we should be getting more of the light in that spectrum in the modern environment. It would be.
Yeah. And I think you have to also take into account people's reaction. I mean, people know this. There's a lot of people that walk in. I can't, those are glary. Those are hard. They're harsh. They use all kinds of words to describe what's going on. And all we're saying is that from a physiological and a neurological standpoint, you have every right to feel that way because you took away literally 90% of the energy that we used to get because we can't see it. So it can't be important. And therefore, it created this situation. Now, what I'm concerned about is that we now have a situation where everybody is constantly being overstimulated on cortisol. And cortisol has a lot of great things it does. But one of the first things it does is you peak up your cortisol, it tanks your innate immune system.
Well, yeah, I mean, cortisol, again, from an evolutionary perspective, cortisol serves a purpose, but it's not supposed to be chronic. It's supposed to be elevated very acutely to do certain things for limited amounts of time.
Yeah, and there was a study by Mello where he took cocaine addicts, and he brought them in and gave them a hit, and then he measured all the different hormone states. And for cortisol in particular, even though the euphoria was over in 30 minutes, the cortisol extended out, only dropped off by 50% in over 2 to 3 hours. So it's kind of like we're constantly taking a beach ball and kicking it up in the air as and going along throughout the day. And especially at night, you know, that the optical pathway for stimulating cortisol and circadian and all that is, you know, is constantly, means that we're constantly getting hyped up or overstimulated, and especially in children, because they're so small that the light penetrates even deeper. So there's a higher percentage of their cells engaged not only in the near infrared, but even into the blues and the cyans.
And so if I'm someone who, let's say in my home, I do not have incandescent light bulbs, my artificial lights inside my home are not emitting very much near infrared light at all. Let's say I replace all of my light bulbs with incandescent light bulbs. How big of a difference do you think that would make in terms of their life?
Well, I mean, depends on the person, depends on the type and the gender. But what I would argue is that typically if we're doing like we are, you're generating 1 to 5 milliwatts per centimeter squared of near infrared relative to a third that in the visible. That level is about 10 times lower than what you'd have in sunlight if you were sitting out in sunlight, or not in sunlight, under a shade tree. So, you know, that's, you know, the relative numbers. Is that a big number? Yeah, it's a big number. I mean, it's still significant, biologically significant, because what we did when we were looking at Zostro's data, we found that free radical generation, and you think this from the physics, is linear with dose. In other words, you know, you can go from over 9 orders of magnitude, and even in darkness, there are free radicals being generated. It's not like that there's some kind of magical threshold where it all goes away. The body is contending, trying to deal with the relative ratios all the way down to what we consider darkness. Because people need to understand that darkness is still 10 to the 14th photons per second, you know, per centimeter squared. It's a, there's a lot of photons in darkness as well as there is in direct sunlight. And, you know, if you pick like a midpoint, that midpoint is about what we have inside our home, you know? So, yeah, I don't know how to directly answer your question, but I guess I'm just saying that
it's a significant amount of light difference in the light ratios, that it's biologically significant.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, you supposedly are not supposed to look at your cell phone at night because of the blue light effect. That's orders of magnitude lower than what we're talking about out of artificial lighting. And that's supposedly creating a biological effect, and because our eyes are responding or whatever. But, you know, I believe it has a huge impact, and I'm concerned that it is setting up a generation for issues. I mean, you see so many modern, and, you know, it's our food, it's the microplastics, it's all these other stuff. The last thing on the list is sunlight for some reason. I don't know why, but, you know, you look at the blue zone people, they'll talk about food, community, everything under the sun. But what they don't mention is that the blue zones actually fall within 37 north latitude and 10 north latitude. And they are almost all the time outdoors, and they have tons of plants around them reflecting near infrared and all this other stuff. But it's never mentioned as being a possibility as to being what is part of the solution. And I see these people that put plants inside their buildings. Well, if you've got a standard low E glass, architectural glass, there's no near infrared coming in. So how's it going to bounce off the leaves of to go to you? So it's like we kind of continually defeat it. Because we don't understand the process well enough, we keep defeating the things that we've been given and not taking advantage of it. And like I say, you know, kids' sports, you and I went out and played till it got dark, you know? They don't do that anymore. And I really think that and unfortunately, it's not a pill. It's not something you can just simply take once and life's good. You know, it's a setting up what is the baseline hormone levels and the ratios of those hormones, you know, that are built up in the body. And, you know, the fact that I can go and take a kid outside and they are multiple studies showing cognition levels are higher outdoor in sunlight versus artificial lighting. That should be enough right there to just strip every light bulb out of the schools, in my opinion. So, you know, like I said, kids in particular is a big deal.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about, you know, red light, near infrared light therapy, when people buy these devices to put in their homes and use them for certain periods of time at the beginning or at the end of the day?
Well, I think if it works for you, that's great. My problem is that it's more from an optic standpoint. If you, the way the body, the nature's set up, the optical watts in the near infrared and far shortwave infrared are spread out over almost 2000 nanometers. Now, what people are doing with these therapies is that they're putting in narrowband, what I call narrowband emitter, that has only 50 nanometers or so of width. In order for me to generate an optical watt in that 50 nanometers, the peak intensity has to be extremely high relative to what goes on in nature. And nature is distributed, kind of like a spread spectrum type thing, where it's spread out over all these different wavelengths. And what it appears to be from what's going on is each one of those wavelengths has some effect, or a different action spectra on various processes within the body. So I don't see how it's any different than doing blue light, you know, narrowband blue. Narrowband blue localized all the effects within, you know, that are associated with those wavelengths. You start to get into trying to do stuff with red. The other thing is that I'm an old laser jock. I mean, in the old days, when you had a near infrared laser, you had all kinds of safety and lockout devices because you don't have the ability to know that beam is on. You know, you can sit on it, may look like, oh, it's just a little red glow. Well, it's not just a little red glow. It's like taking somebody and sitting them in front of a bunch of headlights and propping their eyelids open, you know, if you're not careful. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all bad or whatever, but people don't know, you know, if they could see the intensity level of those peaks.
It's a lot of light.
It's a lot of light. And, you know, we have this crazy mentality that if little's good, more's better. So let's get a bigger panel. And I totally agree that there's an area ratio. You know, the more skin or more area that you're exposing is the higher volume of mitochondria that are being stimulated. But there's a point of diminishing returns, you know, and a little bit of, I prefer. So what we do is we use broadband and thermal emitters to simulate the near infrared. And, you know, is it perfect? No, it's not perfect, but it's a whole lot more closer to what happens in nature than trying to do these. And, you know, you also have to, again, we get back to the ratio issue. If you're trying to match, I have one optical watt of visible and I have to do one optical watt of red or even an 850 nanometer, then I got to pump that. That's a lot of red. And what's the amazing thing about the body, our adaptation is we are collecting all this near infrared via while at the same time we are able to see. If we could see in the near infrared, it would wash out all the blues, greens, reds, and yellows because it would dominate, you know, the spectral response of the eye if it had a broader range. So it's like we've adapted to say, okay, this is important. Everything is, we can live in this area and know that that's a good apple, that's a bad apple, all this other stuff. Yet I can still be pumping in watts of near infrared without affecting that eye response. So.
Well, Scott, like you're a wealth of information. This is incredible because there's just so much I didn't know about this whole area. I think this is a, you know, a very underappreciated area for everyone. We think of light sensing in terms of the eye. We don't consider the whole sort of body as a light sensing organ. We don't, as you said many times, you know, it's easy to forget about what you can't see. So people don't really think about near infrared light because it's invisible to us. Are there any final thoughts you want to leave people with, or anything you want to reiterate about light and its effect on our biology, or how people should think about their relationship to light in general?
Well, I think that as you said, I mean, our behavior, our habits can do a huge benefit. You know, let kids go out and be outside for a while. Let, you know, I understand there's safety issues and all that other stuff, but at least try and not always be in artificial lighting. And it is a, you know, but at the same time, I do want to express that I have a concern that, you know, people don't understand how bright some of these red therapy panels can be and the effect it could maybe have on your eyes and all that. And the fact that if you pick one wavelength, what ratios did you change that we don't know about? Mm-hmm. You know, that's my concern is that we're kind of playing it. So I just think getting people outside more, and it's not like you have to go out and spend all day outside. You know, there's an older gentleman I knew, he's 85, smart as a whip, all there. A German guy, he'd go out every day for 15 minutes, pull his shirt off, even when it was cold, and get a little bit of juice. And it was free, you know. While I'd love to sell you a light bulb, and I think that they're a good way to do it, and a good compromise of between saving energy and healthy lighting, a lot of things we can do that don't cost us anything. And I would also recommend that if people have any further interest, Roger Seeholt's MedCram videos. He's done about 7 of them on our work. And the first one, Light and His Medicine, he's had 4 million views on. And I think that what you're going to see is that the medical communities are going to start coming in. Lighting has typically avoided the medical community to a great extent. And I think that'll be a big change. And the last thing is that I think that once we get more of these biosensors that can measure things in real time, we'll get a much more concise vision of what's going on in the body. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you know, and real quick, I just want to ask you one more thing. You know, obviously everyone is going to do what they're going to do. There's many different opinions. I just want to ask you about sunscreen. How do you use sunscreen in your personal life? Do you use it at all? Do you use certain types? Do you avoid certain types?
I don't use any sunscreen. I mean, I honestly, like I say, I don't use any. I love to walk in the park. I like to bike, you know. And that said, it's obvious that I could use to lose some significant amount of weight. So we all make choices that aren't the best for us sometimes. But you know, to me, there's so many ways that I can get sunlight without causing myself to be charred. You know, I mean, even now I'm getting a little bit red from being out here. Yeah, but I personally don't see the benefit in sunscreen as they do it. If you want to do, for someone like me that really wants protection, I would have to put on something that looked like blackface. And that's to make a significant difference. I think the rest of it is, you know, my dermatologist would disagree, but, you know, that's...
Well, based on what you said earlier... What you told us was the sunscreens will allow you to stay out longer in the sun without getting burned, but you are not preventing that oxidative stress from the stuff that's not being blocked.
Yeah. And to me, I mean, if I get too much, then I start to turn a little pink, I go inside, you know, that's to me, it's the body's natural way of saying, hey, dummy, it's time to get in.
Yeah.
There was a really interesting study done in New York of older people. And what it showed was 126 participants and it was over the age of 70. And it showed that the having some level of non-melanoma skin cancer translated into an 80% reduction in your probability of having dementia. You know, so You can look at sun as being the evil guy. You can look at blue as being the evil guy. But I think the real problem is that we're not, we don't understand how it really works well. Right. It's in ratios. It's in combination. And if you start messing around with those, you know, one can make a pretty good argument that if you have the right hormonal balances in your body based on sunlight, that it maybe helps in other areas. So, and that's what the paper was basically trying to show is that getting out in the sun is good for your mental health as well as your physical health.
Right. I think that's a great place to end it. Scott, thank you very much for your time. This was fascinating. You've written a lot of papers and done a lot of work in this area. The one that I read was called Melatonin and the Optics of the Human Body. It was really interesting. Lots of stuff I had no idea about in there. So I'll link to that in the episode description. Just thank you. Thank you for talking with me.
Well, yeah. And just to shout out to Russ, I mean, I'm an optical engineer. It took a lot to get me to understand anything about biology. And it's people like Russ that were willing to kind of shepherd me through to get to that paper, get it out there. So big shout out to Russ.
All right. Scott Zimmerman, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Bye.
Hey everyone, I want to take a minute to tell you about a really cool health monitoring device I've been using for several weeks. It's called Lumen, and it's a handheld, pocket-sized device with a sleek design. It measures CO2 levels in your breath, which allows their technology to determine the extent to which your body is burning fats versus carbohydrates. Lumen helps improve your metabolic flexibility, your body's efficiency in shifting between using fats and carbs. It improves your ability to burn fat, which decreases your hunger levels and makes your body less dependent on snacking, and it can increase your energy levels by helping you develop a high-functioning metabolism. I use this device in the morning, before bed, and after meals and workouts to track my metabolism. With just a couple weeks of use, I learned a lot about which foods were causing my body to burn mostly fat, mostly carbs, or both, as well as how long I need to fast each day to promote fat burning. Lumen is great for anyone looking to optimize their health for either weight loss or athletic performance. The easy-to-use app allows you to track your results together with what you're eating and how you're exercising, and it syncs with other devices like the Apple Watch. Click the link in the episode description to learn more and use the code MIND, MIND, in all capital letters to get $50 off your Lumen device today.